Hi, Isabella.
Hello, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. Thanks.
Yeah, so this is the third in a series of conversations we've been doing lately about some of the stuff I've been working on.
Yeah, that's right. So why don't we first just get an intro out of, for people who are new to listening to you, Brian, who are you and what are you doing? And I'll just say that I'm Isabella Granick, and I'm really excited about continuing our series of conversations around the work you're doing around philosophy, history, everything basically out there. And we are continuing on from our last conversation. And yeah, maybe you can do your introduction as well.
Yeah, my name's Brian Kam. I'm a writer, podcaster, researcher, working on a project which is now being called Neither Nor, about two different ways of reasoning about the world. And we have been tracing some of those dynamics through a few different conversations. And yeah, maybe I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, that's great. So I do want to continue on our conversation that is pretty much setting the ground for this neither nor approach. But before we dive into that, I was just so excited to hear your conversation with Maggie Appleton that I wanted to at least try to ask you a few follow-up questions, because it's so rare that we get this opportunity to have these kind of follow-ups from podcasts. So would you mind if I dived into a few of those questions?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so you had this fantastic discussion with Maggie about really the implications of these machine learning models that underlie popular AI-run applications like ChatGPT and things like Midjourney and so on. And so for anyone listening to this for the first time, I would first of all highly recommend you just dive into that conversation, because it's super interesting and important, I think. And, you know, besides having a very clear description of what machine learning models do, which I think most of us don't even understand from the get-go, and a lot of the fears, the kind of stupid fears, I would say, about generalized intelligence and what's going to happen around AI are misplaced unless we understand a little bit better what these learning models do. But I thought the much more interesting place you all went to was this conversation around the implications of having ChatGPT-like programs running on the internet instead of, or maybe in addition to, human written text on the internet. And what will eventually, Maggie argues, happen, which is this, you know, overrunning of much of the content on the internet by these AI-driven protocols, and our the potential for it being very, very difficult to differentiate between humans who are writing on the internet and these AI programs. And so that's where I wanted to take off, and I was fascinated by this imperative that seems to start growing that we're going to have to prove our humanity. And I think this directly links to the work you're doing around what do we as humans do when we reason and think, and how is that integrally different from how computers do their computing, or quote unquote thinking and processing. And so that's where I wanted to start. Is it seems that we all have some kind of intrinsic affection for what is our human condition and how we express that. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you think the difference is at this very moment between how we reason and also express ourselves and how these programs, AI-run programs, reason and express themselves. And then we'll take off on the implications of that.
Yeah, it's a great question. So Maggie was coming at the issue from the point of view of how will we know that someone is human on the internet if you can produce a kind of plausible series of photos and blog posts and all kinds of social media presence, including potentially video, without needing someone to actually do that, right? So that all of these things could be generated by AI. So my angle was kind of on the question of where will the training set come from if technologies like these are able to generate text at a much faster rate than humans are. And the question about how do we reason as opposed to computers, I think that's one that's potentially changing right now, because the old programming models are almost all serial, right? And they basically happen in a kind of what we might describe as the forward causal reasoning way. They're typically declarative languages or imperative, and they basically execute a series of steps. There are some other ones that are not modeled that way, but they're less common. So mostly when people learn how to program, you know, the first line runs first, and then the second line, and then the third line, etc. And then you might have functions that divide this up a little bit, or you might have other ways of jumping around a program. But in general, it's sequential, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing that's very different between that and human cognition is that although we have that ability to do sequential reasoning, we are not particularly good at it. So in general, if we need to do long mathematical operations, things like that, we typically need something like paper. We need a way to actually make notes of what we've done, because we just can't store that much stuff in our head.
Right.
And so at the same time, we're able to do quite a lot of parallel processing. Now, one thing that's kind of changing, I suppose, is that these language models, as I understand them, and I am no expert, but they also run concurrently, right? A lot of these things run on GPUs, which have many, many more processes running. I'm probably not going to use the correct terminology for anyone who's deep in the weeds on this stuff. But basically, your desktop computer, you know, these days maybe has 4 cores, 8 cores. I don't know how many the average one has anymore, but like for many, many years, you just had 1 core, basically. You had 1 processor with 1 core in 1 desktop machine. Now there's a few more, but the thing that's really parallelized are graphics processors, and they were originally used for displaying, you know, things for video games and things like that. But now they're being used for other things, including, I believe they're used in cryptography, so they're used for things like Bitcoin, but they're also used for these large language models, as far as I understand it. And again, this is not kind of my area. But there's going to be an interesting thing happening there, because I would say that by default, humans are pretty good at parallel processing and pretty bad at sequential processing. So we do have the ability, like I said, to do long operations, but we kind of run out of working memory fairly quickly. You know, it's pretty unusual to be able to sustain these really long things. They typically require some kind of technology, essentially, as an augmentation, even in antiquity, right? So people are using some way of counting things and some physical objects. This was also something that John von Neumann noted very late in his life. He did a lecture called The Computer and the Brain.
I love it.
Yeah. Do you know it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fantastic. And it's basically a question of how do we think brains work? Because I think it was written in the 40s or maybe early 50s.
Right.
And so there wasn't a huge amount of, I mean, of course, you know, E. Cahal and people like that had been looking at the brain for 50 years already, 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
But there was nothing like what we know in terms of modern neuroscience, right? So a lot of what he's saying is speculative. And at the same time, computing is in its infancy. And he, to a great degree, determines the direction of processing, basically. You know, there's a von Neumann architecture. I don't think it's used anymore, but it was very influential. And I think it is still, you know, parts of it are still kind of roughly what we use today.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a long way of answering your question, but I think what I'm saying is that there used to be a kind of clean division, and almost, I'm going to forget the name of this principle, you know, this idea that computers are kind of good at the opposite things that humans are good at. Can you remember who it is?
It's a kind of
don't, but I want to pick this up. I want to pick this up because it's interesting, the place you went to. I actually had anticipated, and this is why it's so great to have just these open-ended questions, I had anticipated that you were going to go almost the exact opposite way and to say, especially from starting off, and I remember this in your conversation with Maggie too, it's like, what is going to happen once these learning models that are so fast have basically processed all the written text that we have out there, and even non-written verbal text and all the podcasts and so on, audio information, and they've to some degree saturated the stuff that we have uploaded.
Yes.
And there's no new information to add. That's where I think the edge of the interesting starts happening, because where I think you are also pointing to is the differences are about not just the limits in terms of, yeah, we suck at sequential logical processing compared to computers, but also that we can generate new information from a vastly different corpus of data. That is things like interoceptive awareness, our bodies, you know, our bodies are giving us a twitch, or we have an intuition, or we suddenly get excited because somebody says something that reminds us of some childhood poem or whatever it is, that kind of randomness, yet pattern matching to a bunch of information and data that computers will not have access to. Even when, let's say, we have robotics and they're walking around on the earth and so on. So I'm wondering about that, because I feel like a lot of the work that you've done so far in terms of dependent origination and meditation practices and so on are rich in thinking about how to evaluate or how to sit with the interaction between our inner worlds and the outer world, and where that mishmash happens, and what's so unique about that creativity. Does that spark anything for you?
Yeah, quite a few things, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think where I was going initially was just this idea that von Neumann has, that computers and humans must work in completely different ways, because the precision required for sort of digital calculations is very high, and he just doesn't think that there's anywhere in the body that can store this level of precision. At the same time, there's this huge amount of parallel processing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's a lower precision. And also, I suppose the other thing is just a question of speed, which is that he thinks neurons firing, it's just too slow for it to work in the same way that a computer does, because the computer's quickly got much, much faster than us. But there are kinds of computations that computers just can't really do and may never be able to do. And I think maybe that's where you're pointing at, because, you know, these questions of intuition, let's say, or things in dependent origination where you trace things backwards, and there potentially is no way of, there's no sort of causal relationship, but there's a conditional relationship, and we can kind of somehow navigate that, even if we can't give good reasons about why we do it that way. And you might be thinking, well, isn't this also what people say about language models, that there is this kind of problem of introspection? But there's something more going on here, because dependent origination, or kind of these questions about, like, how does evolution work, they require just so much more. I'm not going to be able to describe it well, I don't think, which is that...
No. I was just going to say, I think it's exactly at this place of trying to figure out what these differences are that the interesting, you know, proving our humanity starts being not only important, but giving us some hints as to why right now it's very difficult to reason in real time with other people who have very different worldviews, for example, and so on. So all I'm saying is I love the struggle, and I'd love to just keep hearing more.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if I have a whole lot to say about this, except that language models grasp superficial features, and they make predictions on the basis of those. So basically, you know, in a way, what they're optimizing for is something like superficial plausibility at the moment. That may change in the future, but what humans seem to be good at knowing is something that's not at all based in language. And there might be a primary mistake in thinking that thinking consists in something like language or something like concepts. Because, yes, that's one outward sign. And yes, to get it from one mind to another requires the use of language. But that doesn't mean that at the heart of what is being communicated, the thing is itself linguistic. And if it's not linguistic, there's a certain sense in which no language model can ever touch it.
Yes, I completely agree. And I think this is what keeps, as a developmentalist, keeps haunting me, is that, you know, developmental psychologists early on as AI was being developed and they were trying to get better and better at their learning models and how they program them to learn. In other words, what information they were going to be most reinforced to pursue and what they should more ignore and so on. And so early on, developmental psychologists like Linda Smith were talking about babies don't learn with bajillions of data points to generalize from. They go into their very little world and they look at what in their small, tiny space is relevant to the other adults, to the other humans in that world. And so they follow their gaze, they follow their points, they look at the kinds of ways that they move, and even their utterance, although they're attuned to language, they're much more attuned to the emotional or affective, you know, layering of that language as opposed to the linguistic elements, as you say. And so if that's true, and as we know, these babies are incredible learners. One trial learning is often common and so on. Mm. If that's the case, there's something very different about our humanity and how we learn and how we communicate that learning and what these language models are doing. And this is what I'm trying to, I don't have any answer for this, but this is what I'm trying to poke at with you, is how, above and beyond the interesting strategies that Maggie had suggested around proving your humanity on the internet, are there other ways that we are on a very basic level that might inform how we think about our participation in a creative community like the internet?
Yeah, I do think one of the things that came up in that conversation with Maggie was about the sense in which certain processes are autopoietic, right? This idea that an idea, you know, a school of thought, let's say, is actually not usually reducible to its central texts. And in other words, that certain texts, when formulated from an oral tradition, can capture much or something critical about that process of what was going on at the time. And yet they're never really exhaustive. There's always a kind of sense of something alive at the heart of it, which means that you can endlessly use these texts. I think there's a famous thing about, you know, Freud will, I'm trying to remember who this actually was. I think it was like a French theorist saying that there's a sense in which later writing in philosophy or the humanities or even psychology can illuminate former texts that can't happen in the hard sciences. So what he's saying is something like, Freud can illuminate Marx in a way that Einstein does not illuminate Newton, because there's a sense in which Newton is obsolete.
Now, yeah.
I don't think that's actually true, first of all. Or at least I don't think there's this hard line between the hard sciences and the humanities, let's say. Yeah. But I also don't think that he's wrong. Like, I think that there is a sense in which, for the most important texts, they do illuminate each other, in part because what it means to be a part of a textual tradition is somehow extra textual, which is basically to say that to deeply understand what was going on in, let's say, Freud, is to have something beyond what is contained in any of the texts and that can be used as a set of tools to investigate other areas, let's say. And how that works is not easy to say, because I'm not strictly saying that that is because there's a series of embodied practices and enacted interactions with other people that, you know, add this additional stuff to text that the language models can't get at. I mean something more like there is something at the heart of Freud's writing, or any of these sort of great writers who end up producing a school, that is not actually reducible to any of the words, but that is apprehensible to people through the text. This is what's strange about, you know, this. Because what I'm saying is that there's more than just the text, even if you just read the text.
Yes. I mean, this is deeply reminding me of Ian McGilchrist's work right now, because I'm so immersed in this discussion group and just rereading some parts. And so I think you're absolutely right. Whereas we often, in a sort of superficial way, think of the text as this left hemisphere sequential processing of knowledge and logic and so on, there's something very right hemisphere about what we're doing when we're reading something that's deeply important, and we're experiencing it sort of in this extra way that is about, yeah, pulling in our own experience, and also there is something extra there. And it also reminds me about a topic that I had wanted to dive more deeply into that you've mentioned a couple of times in some of your podcasts, or at least in some of your writing. And it does remind me of this idea you had about the difference between Socrates' notion of orality or conversation versus Xuanzi's, what I think you called, or he calls, illumination. And I feel like this is very related. And if you do too, I wonder if you could just first maybe describe that difference and whether you think this is important right now in thinking about our understanding of how we think about knowledge and sharing and conversation and so on.
Yeah, I think it's deeply related to this question, and I will try to summarize it. I think Plato, in general, provokes strong responses in people, and there's an endless number of readings. Just as we were saying, there's always something beyond the text, and it seems to be a living thing that interacts with different minds in different ways. And so this is just my response to reading Plato. But it seems to me that Socrates, who's often credited with this kind of humility because he's always saying that he knows nothing, although, you know, in my view, this is a kind of rhetorical move that he does for specific reasons. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's this idea that he's got this humility and that he's committed to conversation. And certainly he leaves no writing. And he does describe why he's unwilling to leave writing. And one of the issues is that he feels that text is no longer responsive to a listener, you know, in the way that if I say something, you can ask me questions about it. He feels this is not true of a text. And this is one of the reasons he gives for not writing. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of skepticism of the written word, as well as a commitment to oral engagement, or just, you know, conversation, let's say. Now, the issue I suppose I have with this in Socrates is that he does not seem to me trustworthy. And I think that to some degree, the reason he doesn't want to be written down, or he doesn't want to be writing things down, is because his is a kind of aggressive position, which is designed to undermine the positions of others without putting forward a coherent positive project. And not that he needs to be a systematizer or anything like that, but it's like the idea that he's doing it out of some kind of humility to me is just risible. He's, you know, not doing that, essentially. It's a bad faith argument. And this seems to really anger some people who like Socrates, mostly people who don't read much Plato, from what I can tell. But the opposite of this, I think, is to be found in Xuanzi. Let's see, he's sort of late 3rd to early 2nd century BC Chinese philosopher, and often today called a Taoist, even though he would not have thought of himself that way. And, you know, the history of Taoism is a complicated one. But Zhuangzi says that what he's committed to is what's called illumination. And I think the reason that I feel there's such a difference in these is that I feel that Socrates is engaged in something called heuristics, which is basically he's seeking to win a debate or to make his opponent look stupid. Whereas what Zhuangzi is doing is a kind of collaborative effort to come to a joint understanding of something which can never be reduced purely to words. And this issue of reducing to words is also one that comes up in Socrates, because he's very, very interested in abstract concepts, which he thinks he kind of has an a priori, or he sort of assumes before the conversation that, you know, there's this real gotcha, which is that if the concepts you appear to be using aren't internally coherent or consistent, you are doing something wrong. And, you know, that's one point of view, and certainly one that is very dominant in Western philosophy up until Wittgenstein, at least, and even since then. You know, the Philosophical Investigations in 1951 is a prolonged attack on this position, I would say. Mm-hmm. But it's one that Zhuangzi already makes, which is he already sees the problems with how do we define terms? How do we arbitrate debates? And he says things like, you know, if you and I disagree on a point, then either we're both wrong, or you're right, or I'm right, or we're both right, right? He does this kind of tetralemma, mm-hmm, where it's basically, mm-hmm, neither or both or one or the other. And he then says, well, who would be able to decide this? Because if you bring someone in, that person will tend to be biased in your favor. Whereas if I bring someone in, they'll tend to be biased in my favor. And yet he doesn't really dismiss the idea that conversation itself isn't useful. So he kind of does away with the idea of winning a debate, maybe, or proving something. But he comes to this view that the real thing that's going on in conversation is called illumination. And he does leave it a little bit opaque, I would say.
And not yet illuminated.
Yeah, well, he just doesn't define it, but I think maybe that's part of the exercise as well, which is that, you know, my sense of what he's doing is that, you know, you and I, a series of conversations, can come together rather than by trying to score points or win a debate against each other to a shared understanding that illuminates something of the dark night of whatever's, yes, out there, basically. And so I think that these are two different things, because in a certain sense, yes, Socrates doesn't want to write anything down. Yes, he doesn't think that text is responsive. At the same time, what he's in search of seems to be a kind of certainty, whereas, mm-hmm, what Zhuangzi seems to be pushing towards is much more like a provisional joint understanding that serves a practical purpose or serves as the basis of some kind of shared action, rather than a final resting place after which we can say a concept is exhaustively defined or something like, mm-hmm, that.
Okay, there are so many threads that I want to pull on in this. I find this fascinating on many levels, one of which is, of course, I, like many, you know, Westernly brought up in intellectual contexts like universities, was taught very much about this sort of Socratic method of seeking out understanding through a back and forth questioning. There's two things that I think are important here, because what I don't want is to have listeners devolve into, well, I just disagree. Socrates was a good guy, but he was using, you know, a kind of method that we can't really know anyway because it was translated and we weren't quite there, but that it's either well-intentioned or poorly intentioned and he was an arrogant pain in the ass. Because that's not actually your main point. I think what is much more interesting about what you're saying about the differentiation is where, well, there's a few things, but one of them is where they want to end. And yes, this, I think, is hard to disagree with, which is an ending that might be one that comes to a conclusion, right or wrong, and people might debate whether Socrates cared about how right or wrong objectively anyone can be, but there still was a conclusion of someone getting to a place, and it's someone. Whereas what you're saying is that the methods and the spirit with which Xuanzang was going into conversations was one of collaboration and one of mutual interactive questioning and illumination that could come only through the joining of minds in a way that always kind of had, or at least this is what I'm hearing, please tell me if I'm wrong, had in mind that there really is no conclusion. That's the main point, that there really is no absolute truth we're coming to, but we're coming to a way of understanding that we can share.
Yes.
Is that correct?
I think that's a good description of what I understand Xuanzang and the Taoists to be up to. Mm-hmm. And I think it is important, as you say, to distinguish between these different views on Socrates. So one is the question of, is this in good faith or bad faith? So he claims to be trying to help his interlocutors. And there's a question of, well, maybe he is trying to help them or maybe he's not. And that can be kind of left to one side, because even if he is trying to help them, his understanding of what it means to help someone is to get some kind of conceptual clarity. Whereas
right.
I don't think that's the goal of Xuanzang. I think that Xuanzang is trying to reach an understanding that's good enough to proceed in the investigation. And the assumption, which we can talk about in Pyrrhonism, which is that the danger is not really about being right or wrong in any given instance as much as it is in concluding the search. So if you...
This is either, crucial. This is really crucial. I want you to dive right into this.
Okay, yeah. So this is coming out of Pyrrhonism, which is a Hellenistic Greek form of skepticism, sort of started by this guy Pyrrho of Elis, who, like Socrates, left no writings to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's mostly known to us through a later Greek writer called Sextus Empiricus, who's writing in like the 2nd century AD, so about 400, 500 years after Pyrrho of Elis. But it's a big debate, you know, the degree to which they thought the same things. But the point here is that there are two kind of twin dangers, and you might say that they're not evenly distributed in the sense that one is almost always the one that people fall into, and that is dogmatism. So basically that's the view that the truth is ascertainable and that we have figured it out. The Pyrrhonists would say that the Stoics fall under this, the Epicureans, the Platonists, the Aristotelians. They think they've got a good understanding of how things work, and they have therefore ceased the search and begun arguing with other schools who have fundamental disagreements about the nature of that truth. And so then they embark upon this issue of arguing. And then on the other side, which you might say like 10% of the population or something like that falls into.
Sorry, can I interrupt just for a second to clarify
one thing?
Are you saying that the Pyrrhonist thought of dogmatism as this group of thinkers who understood concepts as a particular way and then went out to, in search of, you know, discussions and arguments to prove that way? Or is it their form of reasoning that was a particular type? In other words, did they have already the answers about what virtue is, what, you know, a good life is, etc., and their that content was something that they were going to go out and defend? Or is it the way that they got to that quote-unquote truth that was important and different?
It's a good question. I would say that it's the view that they have come to a conclusion and found a truth. It's not the method of reasoning. In general, the Pyrrhonists use the same methods of reasoning as the dogmatists.
Okay.
They just hold them to a higher standard. So basically, the way that Pyrrhonism starts out is in the dogmatic vein, which is basically to attempt to find a truth about the nature of things, let's say, or about how best to live. You know, these are kind of some of the questions of philosophy. And so the Pyrrhonists are saying, we want to find out, let's say, what we would say in the modern terms might be like, yeah, what is the truth, or how are we to live? Something like that. What the Pyrrhonists see the other dogmatists doing is embarking upon that search and then stopping too soon, because the Pyrrhonists say, you have not actually sufficiently demonstrated the certainty of your own position, and they do this using logical arguments. So it's not really the case that Pyrrhonists use a fundamentally different type of reasoning, I don't think.
I see. Okay, that's important, because I do think you later on want to differentiate different forms of reasoning, and so you're still, this is something within a, you know, formal logical reasoning method of examining the extent to which you've reached a conclusion and its veracity. And you're saying that basically the Pyrrhonists say, whoa, whoa, these dogmatists stop way too early. They don't investigate deep enough. Is that correct?
That's right. So maybe an example would be useful. So one of the questions about, like, what is a source of knowledge? Because, you know, once you enter this kind of skeptical period, then epistemology comes to be more central. And this happens in antiquity, where, you know, all the earlier philosophers are interested in what's called ontology, like what is out there. And so you have Thales and Anaximander and Heraclitus and all these, you know, we get this simplified version of some of the pre-Socratics that, oh, what they're really interested in is, like, what is behind appearances, and they want to reduce it to one thing. That's like a kind of oversimplified story, but it's good enough that it, what is true is that they are curious about, like, there seems to be a tension between the fact that there is some kind of order, and yet everything appears a bit random, right? And so they want to know, like, what are things made out of, basically. But as you come to question, how do we know any of this stuff, then the discussion shifts from an ontological one to an epistemological one. So that just means shifts from a question of being to a question of knowing. And that's already happened by, let's say, the third century. You know, already it's happening under Socrates, and it's certainly happened by the time of Pyrrho of Elis. Arguably, this happens again in the Middle Ages, and that, you know, maybe 12th century theology is more ontological, and by the 16th century, you're back into these questions of epistemology. That's something I haven't really tried to articulate or argue before, but I think it's potentially plausible as a way of thinking about it. But to give an example, like, so once these epistemological questions come up, because it does seem like we have some kind of knowledge, you know, and it does seem like we can rely on it, right? You know, you and I can both act in the world on the basis of certain knowledge we have, like knowledge of how to do something, or knowledge of how, you know, about of a fact about where a place is, and we can use that knowledge seemingly to get to that place or do the thing that we wanted to do, right? Now, one of the questions is, like, well, what is the kind of authority of that knowledge, or how does that come about? And one potential, you know, there are many different ways you could try to justify knowledge. And one way that dogmatists do try to justify knowledge is by expertise. So they say some people are skilled at this thing, they know how to do it, and therefore that expertise is some basis of knowledge. And to me, that's relatively uncontroversial. I would probably agree with that. But because the Pyrrhonists are in this habit of just kind of debating everything, because... And this is not just as a, it's not, okay, it's not to win arguments. It's actually an ethical position, which is that they think that if you have a strong opinionated commitment to abstract topics, then that's going to set you up for suffering. So basically, they don't argue these things in order to come to their own dogmatic positions, nor do they come to these arguments in order to win arguments against dogmatists, although as I'll describe, their arguments do get used in that way later on. It's like they use these arguments to prevent themselves from becoming dogmatists for ethical reasons.
And could this be likened to a practice that, given a basic sort of value that there is no intrinsic absolute truth, that we have to put ourselves into positions where we keep being reminded of that and experiencing that understanding in real time? Otherwise, we slip too easily into any position. Is that right?
I think it is compatible with that. Yes.
Okay. Okay. Go on.
And so the Pyrrhonist position on expertise is actually, they set up this dilemma. So basically they say either, you know, in order, if expertise is going to be the basis of knowledge, then we also have to know who is an expert. And then who do we ask who's an expert? Well, either we ask people who are not experts, like ordinary people, but it's kind of obvious that they are not going to know what expertise is in a subject that they don't know. So the only alternative is to, in this dilemma they've set up, is to ask experts whether they are experts. And they think that experts can't be trusted about whether they themselves are experts. And so then they try to argue, you know, this is like an example of a Pyrrhonist argument, which is to say, right, well, because there's no way to establish who should judge this, and they say that the one judged can't be the judge of what's good. But I actually disagree with that. So, like, you know, this is an example of, like, the way that they use kind of traditional reasoning to undermine dogmatist positions. But they don't do that just to, like, make dogmatists look stupid, which is what I'm claiming Socrates is doing in terms of heuristics. They're not doing it to win an argument. They're doing it to maintain what they call epoche, which is the suspension of judgment. So basically, they don't want to become dogmatists, and they don't want to become dogmatists because they think that to have dogmatic views leads to suffering. And so they actually don't care too much what you think about it. They just don't want, they want to protect themselves from getting into that state.
So I get that. And I can understand very clearly why there would be a claim that it leads to suffering to hold any of these truths as such, as absolute truths. But what I am confused about is the claim that experts themselves, if I understood correctly, the Pyrrhonists say that experts themselves cannot judge their own level of expertise, and you disagreed. I actually strongly agree, but that may be because I am, you know, still recovering from my academic decades, right? So I think it's extremely difficult as an expert in a field to think about your relative status of understanding that field without falling into deeply held biases that are almost necessary to go forward in any one field. But I want to hear a little bit more about why you disagree with them.
I think I disagree more with the general principle. Like, I would be open to the idea that, yeah, actually experts are bad judges of themselves as experts, and critically, because this is part of their claim, also bad judges of other experts. So in other words, the Pyrrhonist position is that no one on earth can judge whether anyone is skilled at anything. That's the conclusion that they're trying to drive at. That's the part that I think, not sure if I would go along with that. But they see a kind of contradiction as a problem. And so they see the idea that the one judged cannot be judging. Like, they think that this should not be the same thing. And then they say that, you know, outside of that person, no one can judge them because no one has their exact expertise. This is the kind of, like, logical argument that they're making. Does it make sense? Like,
it makes sense, but I am definitely confused because it feels like there is some, either it's completely solipsistic or there's something very internally inconsistent with what they're saying. Because if there is no ultimate, if there is no, not even ultimate, never mind, I totally understand the idea that there is no ultimate judge. However, if there is no relative way of capturing the extent to which expertise is more or less valuable in a context, and in a context is really important. If there isn't any of that at all, what is the entire point of going in and deconstructing any of these arguments or dogmatic positions?
Well,
you see what I'm asking?
Not quite. So I think it goes back to this ethical dimension, right? So they're not trying to establish anything philosophically. Well, it kind of depends who you ask, but I think it's fair to say that the Pyrrhonists are not actually interested in assessing any kind of skill, or that one argument is better than another. Like, in fact, their goal is to not regard any argument as better than any other. And so they're willing to pick up any tool to prevent themselves from having that view. And so I think maybe is what you're getting at, that that would also undermine their own position.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it just sounds like it's goes into such a deconstructive, you know, crazy eating your own tail kind of act that I don't really see where you come out at the end, except in a playful, like, who knows? And, you know, then why start to begin with, I guess, is my point.
Yeah. So that is the goal, is ataraxia, which is unperturbedness. So basically the end goal for a Pyrrhonist is not to have any views on anything. And so, or on any non-evident matters. And this is an important point, because you might think that this prevents you from doing anything. And they're like, absolutely not. Like, what we're saying is this prevents you from having abstract opinions, but that doesn't prevent you from doing anything. So to put it in modern terms, you might say, well, to them, the question of like the economy is good right now, or the economy is bad right now, those are just have no content to them at all. And now you might say, well, if you don't believe one of those things, that will affect your ability to have a job or do a job. And they would say, no, it doesn't. You just don't have to have an opinion about that, you know?
I can accept that. What I still think is difficult for me is the argumentation, the argument or the stance that you ultimately are trying to not have a stance is by its nature a stance, of course. And it's a strong one. That's the thing. It's a different, there's a difference between saying what I am understanding right now as them saying, and saying we are in a constant flux of playful deconstruction with anything, and that is a, you know, sort of the ultimate experiential stance to be in, right? And so, but that even that itself is up for some kind of playful examination. And that's not what I'm hearing you say, but maybe I'm not quite getting it, or I'm not reading them, of course.
Yeah. So this is an apparent contradiction that definitely dates back to Plato. I think it's in the Theaetetus or something, where they basically say, well, if no views are possible, then that view isn't possible, and that's a contradiction. And they do address this, or at least Diogenes Laertius has them addressing this in Pyrrho, which is to say they see it like, I think they describe it as like a hurricane, which destroys everything in its path and then ends itself. So basically, the end goal is not a stance. The end goal is to not play the game, essentially. And they see this strategic undermining of every argument as it arises as a way to first suspend judgment on any question, and then eventually these things just stop bothering you. And this is why I think this kind of relates to dependent origination, because in that practice, the idea is that if you can see this pattern clearly enough, then suffering won't emerge out of it. And if you can untangle all the old ones, then you eventually reach something like Nibbana, which is not, strictly speaking, a state. It's more like a perpetual procedure or something like that, which is like, so there is something sort of final about it, but not in the way that we typically think, because it's not like a state you attain and then that state persists forever. It's more like,
well, it's not a state at all, is what you're saying. It is a constant re-remembering and a re-experiencing that keeps you in this valuable process. And part of what I'm hearing, so first of all, I don't know if we've already made this caveat, but I know shit about philosophy. I know nothing. So if I am restating the most obvious philosophy 101 questions around, you know, not only Pyrrhonism, but everything else, you know, that you're reviewing, I am your, you know, naive listener who's deeply interested and curious, but that's literally my area of expertise, is nowhere close to this. So I do apologize that these questions are too naive, maybe to
No, keep. Not at all. And I should say that, you know, these are things that I'm just interested in reading and engaged with at the moment. And I'm certainly not an expert in, you know, Greek philosophy or anything like that. I'm just speaking about my own exploration of it. And I am trying to read original sources for the most part. And so, you know, this is coming out of reading Sextus Empiricus and everything I can get about Pyrrho and, you know, books on ancient skepticism and things like that. And I think maybe just to respond a little bit to where it felt like you were going.
Yeah.
Like, to me, it feels a little bit like the criticism of Buddhism, which is like, well, won't this end in you not caring about anything? And it's like, well, you know, let's cross that bridge when we come to it, because it's like, you know, it's yeah. like, you know, if that's what you're worried about, like, you know, most people who raise that as a concern haven't really done enough practice to see how hard it is to get anywhere near that. And so right. that's how I view the Pyrrhonist thing too. It's like, okay, here's this kind of maybe slightly soteriological promise that eventually you can have salvation from thinking. You know, if you think that doing this for, you know, a week and a half is going to like cause your brain to melt and you can't form concepts anymore, well, I just don't think that's what's going to happen. I think it'll introduce a level of humility, a level of kind of questioning, a level yes. of inquisitiveness. And yeah, maybe if you did this and nothing else for 25 years, then, you know, well, what the effects of that would be, I don't know. But like, maybe you would come out and you would say, oh yeah, I shouldn't have done that. It really affected my ability to have philosophical debates. But it might also be that it does what it said on the tin, and you reach ataraxia and you're just extremely happy all the time. Like, you know, that's what they say happens. And
yeah.
by all accounts, you know, Pyrrho was like that. So it's a little bit like...
And I think this yeah. is why I go back to this playfulness, right? Because like listening from a particular stance, the Pyrrhonists could sound like they're being contradictory or something like that. But the other thing that I keep wanting to come back to is this sort of playful stance as opposed to combative. And this playfulness is just this constant curiosity that you're poking at things, because just the nature of things, materialist or not, processes, are that they are unpinnable. And so therefore, at least play with that in a constant sort of process, I think seems valuable in itself, but not as a, you know, well, like I said, dogmatic. And sorry, and just one other point that I wanted to ask you about is, it sounds to me like when you describe, especially the Buddhist, well, it sounds like a lot of these practices are developmental, in that it's not about reaching any kind of final state per se. It's about getting there, and that these things are experienced at different points of practice and thinking and, you know, talking with others about that. And it's really important to feel like you're on a path, and that that path is valuable and important, but that not any one place on that path is necessarily that ultimate goal. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's really important. And I think the point that the Pyrrhonists are kind of playful is also quite important, because, you know, they have all kinds of hilarious ways of stopping debates, basically. And so, you know, one would be like, human nature is good or human nature is bad. This is a very popular debate in the 3rd century BC, and maybe it still is. Yeah. And what they like to say is, well, what do you mean by a human? And then they try to go through every possible definition of a human and show why it's inconsistent, basically. And mm-hmm. so the argument is that even the word human can't be defined. And if you can't define the term human, then we can't enter the debate about what human nature is or isn't. And so when you read their arguments, they are sometimes laugh out loud funny, because, you know, right. basically they go through a list of other philosophers who have tried to define what a human is. Democritus apparently said, a human is that which we all know. And the Pyrrhonists say, well, we also know dogs, so does that make dogs human? And then like, right. apparently Epicurus said, a human is what I'm pointing at. And then he would point at a person. And then they say, well, if you point at a man, then it means women are not human. And if you point at a woman, it means men are not human. And stupid things like that, which are just funny, but like you can see what they're doing, which is basically saying, like, we're going to deploy these methods. And again, the point, in my view, is not to make your opponent look stupid. It's to prevent yourself from having dogmatic views. And so... You see what I mean? Just saying,
yeah,
like,
I do.
These are ways not to play the game, basically.
I do. And I do want to push, though, a little bit on this, because I think that, you know, apart from it being just obnoxious if we can't agree that human is a category of things that for now might be good to just pin down with lots of the caveats that there might be, so that we could have a more interesting conversation. What I find difficult about this is that there's a denial of relative, let's say, value in engaging with one another so that we could come to some level of shared, even if it's a temporary, shared perceptual experience together. There's something delightful about having a sense of going through an argument or a dialogue of some sort or something, and then coming through and saying, oh, I see this differently than I had before. And yes, just that very fact, that, like, that's to me a form of, going back to Xuanzi, illumination. And that shared illumination is just delightful. And I feel like it might be missing in this kind of Pyrrhonistic way of, you know, going about business.
It's a good question. I do think that, yeah, the Taoists seem to have a more collaborative element, whereas the Pyrrhonists seem, on the one hand, they do seem to be more interested in just preventing debates from arising. But one of the interesting things is that many of them were doctors, which seems kind of weird, but, you know, they were empiricists. And so they basically thought, you know, what we're interested in is kind of what works. You can see a level of, like, pragmatism in it. Whereas what they're not interested in is theoretical debates. And so I think this is where the difference between what's evident and non-evident comes in, because they think it's perfectly fine to have views on evident matters, you know, like, evidently this thing, you know, kills your patient if you give it to them, and so therefore you shouldn't give it to them, and they're totally fine with that view. But what they're not fine with is the question of, like, you know, is human nature good or bad? Because they're like, well, there would be no evident sign of that, you know, or you, like, they think that when there's a kind of perennial debate around a subject, like, that it's good or bad, and that some people take one side and some people take the other side, that's a kind of sign that it's just, like, one of those things you just shouldn't get involved in that debate, basically.
Well, I think, yeah, there's something that I completely understand and get from that. And then there's a part of me, and maybe it's because I enjoy so much these conversations with you, for example, and pushing and the push-pull of them. And there's just something intrinsically, I don't know, not only delightful and playful about it, but I wouldn't say important, but that there is something energetic about it that feels like I wouldn't want to give that up for purely evident matters.
Well, you know, I guess it all depends on what you mean by evident, because to some degree, you know, they defend their right to think things and say things, which, you know, if you really held the view that you just shouldn't communicate at all, then presumably you wouldn't be involved in these, even these kind of anti-debates that they're doing, you know?
Right.
So, and I do think there is a level of playfulness, and I don't think that they would disapprove of, yeah, I do sense what you mean, and yet, yeah, that may just be kind of my description of them. And, I mean, there's a lot of different views on what they're trying to do, because I think historically they've often been understood as taking an epistemological position that things can't be known, which is the kind of dogmatic, anti-dogmatic stance, which is basically saying, you know, we're going to take the view that because nothing can be known, we therefore cease the search. Whereas it seems like the Pyrrhonists basically say you must continue the search. And there is something hopeful in that.
Yes, yes. Well, I think that's a really good place to wrap up. I'd love to continue the discussion in maybe our next session, thinking about how the Pyrrhonists then relate to later schools of thought, and where these schools of thought develop, or how they develop, and the relations with other different Eastern traditions and so on. So let's bookmark this, because clearly we're not supposed to come to any conclusion.
Yeah, we must not cease the investigation, right?
So exactly. Exactly.
For another conversation.
Exactly. So thank you very much for this conversation, and let's pick it up again soon.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Brian Cam, and you've been listening to Clear Story. Since you've listened to the end of this episode, you're exactly the kind of person that I would love to hear from. So please visit briancam.com, where you can find links to my social media and other ways to contact me. If you would like to receive infrequent updates about my work, please subscribe at briancam.substack.com. If you're interested in supporting my work, please visit patreon.com/briancam, where I post everything that I'm working on. Both of those links are in the show notes, and I look forward to hearing from you.